Matt and Andy's Excellent Adventure. Two words describe their week of snow and ice in Colorado, but amazing and awesome isn't the half of it. By Matt Crossman. I have a bad habit of saying without thinking when an editor asks if I will take an adventure assignment. I love to write. I love finding the edge between comfort and calamity, and, aside from occasional purple bruising, paragliding, sliced finger, bow and arrow, and cut nose, we'll get to that soon, I usually come back in one piece. And so it was that I agreed to enter the Fat Bike World Championships in Crested Butte as part of a trip to Colorado that I called a week-long adventure in snow and ice. Why was this a bad idea? Let me count the ways. I had never ridden a fat tire bike. The temperature that morning dipped to a windy negative 11. Organizers called the loose snow on the course the worst conditions they had ever seen. And the last time I rode a bike in Colorado, I flew over the handlebars and landed on my face. I arrived at the starting line with modest goals. Don't get hurt and don't come in last. I had concerns about both, but they washed away when I looked at the fat tire bike fanatics gathered around me. This was not a super serious race, or even a remotely serious one. One grown man was dressed like a rainbow unicorn, two women wore Care Bear pajamas, and a third woman, who looked to be in her 60s, raced in a red fox outfit, complete with tail. The race started with a run to our bikes. Out of an abundance of caution, I lagged behind, not wanting to get in anybody's way, in case that rainbow unicorn's horn was real and he wasn't afraid to use it. Two steps in, someone on my right fell ass over apple cart. I gawked, which slowed me down even more. As I neared my bike, I realized I was overdressed, so I shed my winter coat and gave it to my friend and teammate Andy, which allowed even the person who had face-planted me to pass me. All of which is a long way of explaining that I was in last place before I even climbed onto my bike. Andy and I arrived in Colorado on an unseasonably warm Saturday night. It was the only time all week the temperature rose above freezing. We have been on many adventures together, and a week-long adventure in snow and ice promised to be an all-timer. We planned to snowboard Copper Mountain, cross-country ski Tennessee Pass Cookhouse, fat tire bike ride Crested Butte, and ice climb Ouray, none of which I had done before. We also planned to ski Winter Park and Monarch Mountain, my first time in 21 years, and ice fish Dillon Reservoir, first in 35 years. We wondered if our brains, which think we are 20, would overrule our bodies, which know we are in our 40s. We decided that a successful week-long adventure in snow and ice would mean neither one of us had to call the other's wife from the ER. Early Sunday morning, we hustled into Denver's Union Station to board the train to Winter Park. Clickety-clack, the city gave way to the suburbs. Clickety-clack, we entered the mountains. Clickety-clack, the mountains soared above us on every side. We walked as if on a rope bridge from the last car to the lounge car, which offered food, drink, and a glass ceiling for stunning views. We squeezed into seats that faced north, but our bodies swiveled around. We gaped at the rocks and snow and trees. Amazing, Andy said. Awesome. Skiers walked to and fro, dressed in long underwear and boots with goggles perched on their heads. The conductor said people who left Denver in their cars an hour before us would not get to Winter Park until an hour after us. The train, the only one in the country that goes directly to a ski resort with no stops, would have been worth it even if it were the other way around. We arrived at Winter Park and wanted to sprint to the slopes, which are only a few steps from the station. I strapped on boots and skis and hit the bunny slopes with my instructor, the ever-patient Abby. Andy, a more experienced skier, spent the day with a guide named Mark, who took him on all the best runs, like a local fixer who knows all the top restaurants. Winter Park is one of the few resorts in the country with such a program. Pro tip: do not rent a sedan in Colorado in the winter. Even the drives to get to the adventures were adventures in and of themselves. We put 550 miles on our rented SUV, many of them through blinding snow, atop icy roads, or both. The resorts we visited all average at least 300 inches of snow a year. Andy and I estimated that at least a foot fell on us that week. We drove through three separate blizzards in one day. On this week-long adventure in snow and ice, I fell on my face snowboarding many times, crashed a fat tire bike even more, wiped out skiing comparatively few, and hung 50 feet in the air from the top of a frozen man-made waterfall twice. But the only time I worried about my safety was driving to Copper Mountain after dinner at Tennessee Pass Cookhouse. The snow fell so fast and in such big flakes that in order to be able to see where I was going, I could go no faster than 35 miles per hour. The view out our windshield looked like the view from the Millennium Falcon when it hit light speed. Fresh powder, the dream of every winter sports junkie, created a nightmare on the highway. I couldn't see where my lane began and ended. I hit rumble strips and did not know if I had drifted left or right. I slowed down more. The 31-mile drive should have taken 36 minutes, but instead lasted more than an hour. The next day we drove the same road in the opposite direction and with clear skies. Snow balanced on branches, the brilliant white contrasting with the black bark, green needles, and blue sky. "Amazing," Andy said. "Awesome." I scanned vast, unblemished fields, looking for footprints from people or animals or both. I traced the tops of the mountains with my eyes up and down, wondering how tall those rounded peaks were, what it would be like to climb them, how cold it would be up there, what the wind would feel like on my face, and drifted onto the rumble strips again, not because I couldn't see the lanes, but because I wasn't watching where I was going. Back at the bike race, I climbed aboard and looked ahead at the course. Imagine a field thick with snow. Now imagine someone blazed a 10-foot-wide trail that looks vaguely like an 8 without the crisscross in the middle on that otherwise pristine field. That's what the racetrack looked like. I rode downhill, turned right, and pedaled from last to next to last to, who cares. The first third of the first lap was like riding through 10 inches of uncooked rice while my kids hit me with pillows and my brothers threw tennis balls at me. I went sideways more than I went forward and finally gave up and walked my bike for about 100 yards. I climbed back on and figured out that the way to ride for more than 10 feet without crashing was to never turn off the thin path created by the tires of the person in front of me. For a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, I followed a guy in a blue shirt. "Hey," I said to myself as I panted and wheezed and tried to slow my thumping heart, "I think I'm starting to figure this." And before I knew what was happening, my front tire turned perpendicular to the rest of the bike. I let go of the handlebars, my feet lifted off the pedals, and I flew off of the bike and landed in the soft, soft snow. I could not feel the snow's coldness or wetness. I merely floated in it, as if in a spider's web. I shoved my right hand down, 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 to try to push off the ground, and my hand never reached it. I was still lying sideways, now almost completely submerged, like I'd taken too literally the assignment to go a week-long adventure in snow and ice. Completely miserable and full of joy at the same time, I laughed as other bikers pedaled, walked, and careened by. I tried to walk, but couldn't because the snow was too deep. I rolled sideways and shimmied back onto the path and continued the race. Later, when I pedaled by the same spot, I cast a sideways glance and saw a me-shaped divot in the snow. Three laps later, there were two more holes, shaped like other people. I had only ridden a fat-tire bike for a few laps, and already I was a trendsetter. The next day, Andy and I sat outside a coffee shop called Mouse's Chocolate and Coffee in downtown Ouray. The San Juan Mountains surrounded us on every side, still jagged and sharp, like the old hockey player's broken-toothed smile. Halfway up the mountain in front of us, hikers traversed a razor's edge trail. "Amazing," Andy said. "Awesome." Then he laughed at himself. "I've said those two words so many times I need to work on my vocabulary." I wanted to linger with my cappuccino because the view was beautiful, and also because for months I had half-dreaded our ice-climbing lessons at Ouray Ice Park, scheduled for that day. Ouray Ice Park is a box canyon with water faucets at the top. Turn on the water, it pours down the rock face, freezes, and voila, an ice-climbing mecca. The ice park is unique in the world and draws climbers from all over the globe, never more so than during the Ouray Ice Festival, held every January. Our visit coincided with the festival, which is why there was no line at the coffee shop and nobody on the streets. Everybody was at the park. We were due to join them, and I was, I am not ashamed to admit, nervous. I have fought a fear of heights since first grade, when my parents drove us across the two narrow bridges that connect the Florida Keys, and I thought we were going to get sideswiped by a semi on the other side, fly over the rail, and plunge into the Gulf of Mexico. I didn't want to, if you'll pardon the expression, freeze while ice climbing. But as we walked to the park, our guy, Zach, put me at ease. The way he explained the rope system made me believe in the rope system, which was no small feat. Sometimes my fear of heights might more accurately be called a fear that thing, bridge, rope, carabiner, whatever, is going to break. I've worked with guides in all manner of adventures, and none have made me think, "Let's do this," like Zach did. He tied me in and pointed me to an ice wall. With crampons like talons on my feet and ice picks like claws in my hands, I marched forward with confidence I had not earned. "Fake it till you make it, baby." I smashed the right claw into the ice. Chips broke off and flew everywhere, and the claw bounced out. I smashed it again, and it found purchase. I smashed the left one into the ice. It bounced out. I smashed it again, and it held. I kicked the spikes of the crampons into the wall, took a deep breath, and pulled myself up. Pushing my body against the ice, I swung with my right arm, and smack! Ice scattered everywhere, again. I aimed for a divot, as Zach had taught me, found one, and soon I was a few feet higher. I didn't look down, not because I was afraid, but because I was concentrating on where I was putting my hands and feet. I was halfway to the top before I realized I'm climbing this freaking frozen waterfall. I could have kept going, but Zach called me down to give Andy his turn. I shimmied all the way to the top the next time. By my final climb, I was disappointed that the top was only 50 feet. I wished it were higher. Back on the ground a few minutes later, my legs hurt from holding my body weight, my shoulders burned from pulling myself up, my fingers ached from squeezing the picks, and I had a big dopey grin on my face. "Hey," Andy said, jolting me from my reverie, "you're bleeding." An ice shard had nicked my nose, leaving a bright red spot. I took a selfie for proof. I smiled even bigger and dopier after that. XL Statement Maker. Photographer Carol Romero's Indigenous Subject Matter Tackles the Big Stuff by Chuck Thompson. It was a big platform from which to make a really big statement. No venue could have been more suited to photographer Carol Romero's strengths. From February to April 2019, 5 images from Romero's Jackrabbit, Cottontail, and Spirits of the Desert series were turned into billboards that greeted drivers along a half-mile stretch of the Gene Autry Trail, a piece of Southern California highway that partly connects L.A. and Palm Springs. The installation was part of the recurring Desert X exhibition. The response to Romero's contribution was appropriately XL. "I received more fan letters than I could have imagined," says Romero, who grew up on the Chemehuevi Valley Indian Reservation along the California side of Lake Havasu and now lives in Santa Fe. People were going out and taking selfies with these billboards, standing on their cars, playing guitars in front of them, trying to look as cool as they could. Titled Evolvers, the most arresting image depicted 4 young boys from Romero's reservation sprinting through a Mojave Desert wash against a backdrop of giant wind turbines. Visually stunning on its surface, the image continued Romero's focus on the way industry has impacted Native American lands. Her Water Memory features haunting images of indigenous figures tumbling through water. "Our country is built on developing indigenous landscapes for industry and big energy, from gold in the Black Hills to oil and hydroelectric power to fossil fuel and solar. You name it," she says. "It's typically large swaths of seemingly empty landscapes. But those landscapes were not empty. They have a rich history of indigenous peoples." Romero's deepest work is inspired by the history of her own tribe, which was flooded out of its traditional valley when the U.S. government asserted the right of eminent domain to build Parker Dam and created Lake Havasu in the 1930s. "A lot of our ancestral territory is under Lake Havasu," she says. "Many of these developed areas were riparian belts full of cottonwoods and willows and wild game and things natives needed. Our tribe ended up on a windy mesa you can't farm." Big historic events, big ideas, big reproductions. The running theme in Romero's work is no accident. She and her husband, Cochiti Potter Diego Romero, often discuss the impact of size on works of art. "We've decided the size of images is just as interesting as the content," she says. "As a photographer who's formally trained in commercial and fine art, you want to have tack-sharp images with really high resolution. If you're able to bring them to a large size, it means there are no mistakes in the file, no digital noise, no flaws in the pixels. It's really the highest form of craft in photography." Part of the goal in presenting traditional native figures in modern industrial settings is to, as Romero puts it, examine how our indigeneity manifests in contemporary times. As an artist, she respects the impact of famed ethnographic photographer Edward Curtis and cites his influence. But she wants to move beyond the legacy created by the portraits of Native Americans he took in the early 20th century. "I think most Native Americans appreciate Edward Curtis's work," she says. "Where it becomes problematic is it defined an end to a culture that did not end. We lived on, and we have amazing lives, sometimes happy, sometimes tragic. We live on reservations, we live in cities. I'm interested in all of these ideas." Combined with exceptional technical skill and a unique vision, that outlook ensures more big things for Romero. Delta Documentarian. Photographer Rory Doyle finds his most awarded subject matter among his neighbors in rural Mississippi and follows that same cowboy muse to the Bill Pickett Rodeo in Memphis and competitions in Cuba. By Chuck Thompson. When Rory Doyle stepped into the middle of the annual Christmas parade in Cleveland, Mississippi, in December 2016, he had no idea he'd just taken the first steps of a journey that would lead him to London, Berlin, and beyond, or that it would make him, barely 2 years later, one of the world's most celebrated photographers. Yet, that's exactly what happened to the man who at the time was the full-time staff photographer for Delta State University. "It's really hard to comprehend," says Doyle, now 36, a Maine transplant who's lived in Mississippi for a decade. What brought Doyle and his camera into the street that day was an appearance by the Delta Hill Riders, a long-established group of African-American cowboys and cowgirls based in the rural Mississippi Delta. The photos he snapped at the parade led to a relationship with the group, an invitation to document a Black Heritage Rodeo in Greenville, Mississippi, and an ongoing photo project that's since racked up many prestigious awards. In 2018, his Delta Hill Riders series won first place in the National Press Photographers Association's Best Online Gallery competition and earned Doyle the Photo Journalist of the Year Award at the world's largest photography competition, the IM Photo Awards in Berlin. In 2019, he was grand prize winner of the Smithsonian Photo Contest and the Zeiss Photography Award. Late last year, he traveled to London to show the project in the Taylor Wessing Photographic Portrait Prize exhibit at the National Portrait Gallery. "My career has definitely changed," says Doyle, who's now a full-time freelance photographer with publication credits that include The New York Times, Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, and ESPN, the magazine. Black cowboys have been photographed and documented before, going back almost to the advent of the medium. An 1876 shot of Nat Love, a.k.a. Deadwood Dick, portrays the former slave-turned-cowboy with hat, lariat, and saddle, a document from the post-Civil War era of the great cattle drives, when freed slaves like Love found work in the West. By some estimates, one in four cowboys was black, and the tradition continues today. Why isn't that more well-known and more widely represented? Doyle doesn't seek to answer those questions so much as just capture the compelling proof of contemporary black cowboy culture. What makes his Delta Hill Riders project unique is the tight bond Doyle was able to develop with his subjects. A startling intimacy is conveyed in each image, whether featuring a raucous dance at a local club or a cowboy father holding his newborn son on his first day home from the hospital. "These people are my neighbors," says Doyle, who shoots primarily with Sony and Nikon bodies and Zeiss lenses. "None of this would have been possible without the people opening their lives to me." The Smith family from Charleston, Mississippi, has been central to the project. "Their father started the tradition," Doyle says. "His son, now in his late 70s, told me, 'I've been writing for more than 50 years, and no one's paid any attention.' They really enjoyed being heard and were willing to open up." In the field, Doyle keeps a relaxed, low profile. He says earning trust with subjects is as important to a good photo as equipment or technique. The approach is evident in another of his continuing projects, Global Cowboys, which so far has documented horse culture in countries including Mexico, Jamaica, Colombia, and Canada. One of its most arresting images features a young competitor at a rodeo in Sancti Spiritus, Cuba, an event Doyle and his wife sought out while on a trip. "The cowboy scene in the town is so strong, it means so much to the people there," he says. "It's interesting because a lot of the equipment in Cuba is passed down. You see riders in chaps from Mexico and helmets from the United States." Doyle is extending both series. He'll soon begin making audio recordings of the Delta Hill Riders and hopes to publish a book. "Right now it's a survey project," he says. By interviewing some of the writers, I can get their voices in there. Let them tell their own stories. Shadow Catcher. Photographer Shane Balkowicz celebrates the modern faces of Native America using an Old West technique. By Lance Nixon. Shane Balkowicz didn't foresee the way history would come circling back around when he constructed what is probably the country's first new natural light wet plate photography studio built in more than a century. He began to figure it out when Ernie LaPointe came to pose for a portrait in September 2014. For a photographer persevering in a cumbersome technique invented in 1851 that nevertheless creates lasting images of incredibly fine detail, the chance to do that portrait brought to mind the work of an earlier photographer whom Balkowicz reveres. Orlando Scott Goff was a wet plate artist here in Bismarck, North Dakota, and he captured this image, which was the first image ever taken of Sitting Bull. 135 years later, I captured Ernie LaPointe, the great-grandson of Sitting Bull, in the same process, in the same city. Balkowicz says from his nostalgic glass wet plate studio in Bismarck, "That's portrait number one for the series." The series Balkowicz is referring to took shape soon after LaPointe sat for that portrait. Looking at the face of Sitting Bull's great-grandson, Balkowicz realized that one key aspect of the work of Goff and other early frontier photographers taking portraits of Native Americans was unfinished business. There was room for a 21st century treatment. Balkowicz came up with the idea of doing 1,000 portraits of Native Americans. From each set of 250 portraits, he plans to publish a book of 50. His first set led to the first book of an eventual three-volume project, Northern Plains Native Americans, A Modern Wet Plate Perspective, Artist Edition, Volume 1, published in May 2019, followed in October by a trade version put out by New York-based Glitterati Editions. A portion of the sales of the book and prints from the series benefit the American Indian College Fund. Just as 19th century photographers did, Balkowicz depends on natural light for his portraits. No flash and no studio lights unless the sun won't cooperate. At his suggestion, subjects bring whatever regalia or objects they want in the photograph. Using a stand or brace to keep their heads still for the several seconds needed to take a photograph, he tells them to think of something important to them while they wait out the 10-second exposure, so that, ideally, some sense of who they are might come through in the portrait. Remarkably, Balkowicz was not a photographer before 2012. He never took a class and had no formal training. But he became fascinated with wet plate collodion photography, a chemical-laden process developed by Frederick Scott Archer in 1851. While Balkowicz substitutes at least one chemical for a safer, modern alternative, he follows essentially the same method popularized in the mid-19th century. But it's not for a love of things retro. There's nothing backward about this, he says. These are some of the highest resolution images ever made. What you see is pure silver on glass. What's beautiful about pure silver is its archivability. All these inks and pigments and paints and dyes that we use, they all fail us over time. This will be here 1,000 years from now, unbroken. It's for that reason that early wet plate photographers called themselves ambrotypists, a term coined from the Greek words for immortal and impression. That's the term Balkowicz still uses for himself on his business cards. Shane Balkowicz, ambrotypist. There's been kind of a revitalization of the process. There's about 1,000 of us in the world presently that are practicing, he says. I do it for history, knowing these images will be here long after I leave this earth. The State Historical Society of North Dakota is already archiving his Native American images as valuable historical records of 21st century people. Although Native American portraits are a main focus of his work, Balcowicz will photograph anyone who will wait out the 30-minute preparation of the wet plate and then sit still for the 10-second exposure. The complex process requires that he do most of his work in his Bismarck studio, where he has received some notable subjects. One of his studio images, of former world heavyweight boxing champion Evander Holyfield, is in the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery. But Balcowicz can go mobile, as he did last October when he dashed down to the Standing Rock Indian Reservation with his portable darkroom to make a portrait of Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg. As gratifying as those high-profile shots might be, one honor surpasses them all. The Hidatsa held a ceremony and gave him a name in their language. They called him Maishta Takishi Agushi, Shadow Catcher, which Balcowicz calls the greatest honor of my life. Siempre Selena. The queen of Tejano music was murdered 25 years ago in Texas at age 23, but her legacy will live forever in the hearts of old and new fans alike. By Joe Nicky Potoski. Photography by Al Rendon. You've seen the face and the likeness on street murals from San Francisco to Chicago, on a bridge in San Antonio, on a commemorative drinking cups and T-shirts, on bumper stickers and album covers. The image is unforgettable, a beautiful young woman with full red lips, burnished brown skin, and a full head of dark hair. Maybe you've heard her music or just heard her name. Either way, you can't help but wonder, who is Selena? She was La Reina, the queen of Tejano music, the rising star and standard bearer of the regional sound made by Mexican Americans in Texas, a sound that was on the verge of crossing over into the mainstream popular arena. She was all of 22 when I met her, a flower in full bloom, knockout gorgeous, charismatic, and comfortable in her own skin. She was a role model to young Mexican-American girls who had precious few role models to look up to. She endorsed Coca-Cola. She was smart, successful, and clearly destined for greatness. All that promise was cut short on the last day of March 25 years ago when Selena Quintanilla Perez was shot and killed in a crime of passion by Yolanda Saldivar, her fan club president, business associate, and best friend. The tragedy remains fresh for her longtime fans and increasingly for new converts, not all of whom are Mexican Americans in Texas or the Southwest. They are people of all colors, from all walks of life, from all around the world. Many weren't yet born when Selena was alive. They've heard her voice, seen video clips of her storied Astrodome performance, and are drawn to the uplifting life story that ended abruptly in death, darkness, and tragedy. I know a few things about Selena. As a Texas-based music writer, I had followed her trajectory in Tejano music from captivating teenage singer, performing with her sister and brother, to the confident young woman who was the biggest star in that musical genre. In the early 1990s, her band, Los Niños, was selling hundreds of thousands of records, more than even ZZ Top or Willie Nelson. She was the complete entertainment package, a powerful singer, a physical dancer, a commanding presence on and off stage. Her songs ran the gamut. Ballads, such as her biggest English-language hit, Dreaming of You, and the story song about forbidden love, Amor Prohibido, showcased her exceptional emotional range. Her powerful vocals were the signatures of the crunching cumbia rocker La Carcacha, the traditional Mexican ranchera El Toro Relajo, and the nonsensical sing-along Beady Beady Bom Bom. Selena y Los Dinos were part of a musical wave, along with the Houston band La Mafia, Grupo Maz from the Rio Grande Valley of deep South Texas, and Emilio Navarra from San Antonio, that was putting Tejano on the map. She recorded a duet with David Byrne and sang mariachi in a film starring Johnny Depp. Her crossover into pop music, the general market, as Mexican Americans call it, was imminent when I interviewed her for Texas Monthly Magazine in the spring of 1994. But as we sat and talked on her tour bus before a show in Austin that night, she seemed more interested in telling me about her Selena Etc. boutiques in San Antonio and her hometown of Corpus Christi and the fashion line she was developing. The band she performed in, with her producer brother A.B. on bass and her sister Suzette on drums, was her father Abraham's idea, born out of his inability to crack the big time with his early 1960s doo-wop group, the Dinos. Fashion and the Selena Etc. boutiques were her ideas. Chatting across the table, she had me mesmerized. Dressed casually in a white sweatshirt and jeans, she was strikingly beautiful, without the heavy makeup she always wore in public. Animated and very much in command, hushing Father Manager Abraham, who was sitting on the nearby sofa with her mom, Marcella, when he interrupted to add to the conversation. After almost an hour, I walked off the bus feeling lightheaded and totally smitten. This woman could do whatever she set her mind to, and be whomever she wanted to be. The next Gloria Estefan, or the next Madonna? Absolutely. Maybe bigger, from what I could tell. 9 months later, Selena lay dying in the lobby of the Days Inn in Corpus Christi, her hometown, killed by a bullet fired from a Taurus revolver held by Yolanda Saldivar. The manager of Selena's boutiques and her constant companion, Saldivar, had been accused of stealing money from the fan club and Selena's businesses, but Selena refused to believe the accusations until shortly before the shooting. The two had argued in front of Yolanda's hotel room, and Yolanda shot Selena, who ran toward the lobby seeking help, collapsing by the front desk. Her sudden death was a cold ending to a too-short life story of grit, determination, and inspiration. Her rise from blue-collar roots, growing up speaking English and learning Spanish in her culture, achieving unprecedented success in a male-dominated field, and serving as a spokesperson for young Hispanic girls is a compelling tale. The tragic twist made her the icon she is today. Despite the triumphs, "it's so sad," is the refrain I hear most often from her fans today. She's become symbolic, a folk heroine like Frida Kahlo. Her records continue to sell, her videos continue to rack up views, and other artists continue to cover her songs, as Kacey Musgraves did when she brought down the house and made front-page news singing Como La Flor at the 2019 Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo. The reaction to Selena's death in Mexican-American communities around South Texas was like the reaction in my hometown of Fort Worth to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas back in 1963. Vehicles turned on their headlights in daylight. Selena Forever messages written with white shoe polish on their windshields. Pop-up shrines appeared everywhere, at the Selena Etc. boutiques in San Antonio and Corpus Christi, on the chain-link fence outside the Quintanilla residences in the Molina neighborhood, around the door of room 158 at the Days Inn, where the shooting occurred. People walked around dazed and shell-shocked, like a bomb had gone off, and they didn't know what to do. The posthumous album Dreaming of You was the best-selling Latin album of 1995 and 1996, moving almost 3 million copies. People magazine and Texas Monthly set record newsstand sales with Selena covers. I wrote a book, Selena, Como La Flor, one of several written about Selena. That led to a live appearance on the Univision talk show El Show de Cristina, Cristina Salagri, being the Oprah of Latin America, along with other Selena authors. At the end of the program, a Puerto Rican book critic declared my book to be the only legitimate biography. The other books trafficked in rumors, myth, and speculation, the book critic said. The day after the Christina appearance, I returned to work at Texas Monthly. No one there seemed aware of my turn on Spanish-language TV, except the cleaning lady, who buttonholed me in the commissary and with wide-open eyes and a big smile exclaimed, "I saw you on Christina." The largely Anglo staff of Texas Monthly had no clue. The 1997 music biopic Selena, with Jennifer Lopez in an early star-making role and Edward James Olmos playing a credible Abraham Quintanilla, remains the most popular entry point for people discovering Selena, even more than her recordings. Box Office Mojo ranks it as the 15th highest-grossing musical biopic of all time. She would have been 49 this April. 25 years after her death, Selena is bigger than ever. The Selena Makeup Collection, a joint venture between MAC Cosmetics and the Quintanilla family, flew off the shelves when the line was introduced in 2016. Selena the Series, the official story of Selena, starring Christian Serratos, is airing on Netflix. The telenovela El Secreto de Selena, adapted from the book by TV personality Maria Celeste Herreras, who covered the Selena trial, aired on Telemundo. I sensed the groundswell in the fall of 2018 at an event at the Guadalupe Theater in San Antonio. CNN's sister network, HLN, had organized a forum to coincide with the airing of a Selena special. HLN had filmed me at my home and then invited me to the Guadalupe to share the stage with Carlos Valdez, the Nueces County District Attorney, who successfully prosecuted Yolanda Saldivar. Convicted of first-degree murder, Saldivar, a former registered nurse who at 59 remains incarcerated in Gatesville, Texas, will be eligible for parole in 5 years. Retired from public life, Valdez travels around Mexico as a consultant, explaining the American legal justice system to prosecutors and judges. Lori Castro Camacho, a 48-year-old woman from Goliad, Texas, with a bubbly personality not unlike Selena's, asked Valdez and me to pose for photographs with her, as several people did that night. She told me about how Selena's image on an album cover caught her attention in 1992 before she had heard her music. "I just felt she had the it," Camacho said, and she still did. "Hearing her makes you feel like she is alive. I made the trip to her museum 2 years ago, and I felt her presence. Her last concert was playing on a large TV screen, and I started singing along. I got goosebumps. My eyes filled up with tears. Something she said came to mind. The idea is not to live forever, but to create something that will." I had a knot in my throat. In my mind, my response was, "You have, Selena. You have." Joe Ojeda, the keyboardist for Los Dinos, and Pete Astudillo, the band's featured male vocalist and composer, drove up from Laredo for the CNN event. Both were still performing, they told me, but their smiles vanished when I asked if playing now was like it was with Selena. "No way." But no matter where and when they played live, Astudillo and Ojeda said they always carved out a few songs for Selena. The crowd wanted it. They wanted it. I'd run into Astudillo a year earlier at a fundraiser in Austin, where he was a featured guest performing with Stephanie Bergara, leader of the tribute band Bidi Bidi Banda. Bergara intrigued me. A City of Austin program coordinator who had worked for managers, booking agents, studio managers, and publicists, she had gotten together with 9 musician friends to make Selena music informally 5 years before, and the band blew up into a thing. The daughter of blue-collar, second-generation Mexican-American parents, Bergara was raised on Tejana music. She was inspired to sing by Selena's ballad, No Me Queda Más. Vergara, who had been raised speaking primarily English, asked her mother to translate the lyrics so I would know where to emote. There is not a show where I sing that song that tears don't start. Seeing Selena on TV changed Vergara's life. Selena was the first person who I ever saw on television who looked like she could be related to me, she said. She was so sparkly and amazing. I wanted to be on stage singing, just like her. I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I said to myself, that's it. That's what I want to do with my life. I want to be like her. Vergara's band rehearsed 6 songs for 3 weeks, then played the Empire Control Room in downtown Austin to a packed house. I knew how much I loved Selena, Vergara said. I had this hope other people loved her as much as I did. Beady Beady Banda's tribute repertoire now includes several dozen songs. If you want to come to a Selena dance party, my 7-piece band has worked very hard to replicate these songs, Vergara said. They play them as close to the original as possible. I want people to come to our show, close their eyes, and believe that they're at a Selena show. For Vergara, it's tragic to think that the Queen of Tejano is remembered more now than celebrated when she was alive. We played a private event for Google last night. Someone showed up in a Selena t-shirt. She's as big as she ever was. Martin Gomez, who was Selena's designer for both her stage wear and the fashion line that was in development at the time of her death, reached out to me last spring. He wanted to write a book about his work with Selena and sought my advice. Gomez was the one who went to Selena's father to warn him about Yolanda Saldivar's erratic behavior and failure to pay for employees' insurance and other expenses for Selena's fan club and businesses. Abraham's subsequent investigation uncovered evidence Saldivar was stealing from Selena. For close to a month, Selena refused to believe the accusations. She was meeting Saldivar at the Days Inn to retrieve financial records when Saldivar shot her. Gomez had had virtually no contact with the Quintanilla family since her murder, all the while wondering if Selena might still be alive if he hadn't exposed Saldivar's embezzling. Gomez and I met just north of San Antonio in the tourist town of Greene. Now an executive with the Asena Retail Group, he wanted to set the record straight. I was her fashion designer, he said. Selena wasn't designing. I designed the product. It was just her and me doing it. It was the first celebrity brand of its kind. Gomez had just reconnected with the Quintanilla family. He had thought the family was mad at him since he wasn't chosen to design costumes for the Selena film. He learned the family thought he had moved on to pursue his fashion career at Dillard's. It lifted a burden for me, realizing we're all in a different place, Gomez said. The best part was seeing his costumes displayed in the Selena Museum, part of Abraham's Q Productions headquarters in Corpus Christi. I hadn't seen them since the last time she wore them, Gomez said. It was super emotional, but going back wasn't cathartic. It was just sad. Someone was completely cheated of greatness. I've moved on and enjoyed an extremely successful and lucrative career in design and fashion. She and I had conversations about going to Fashion Week in Paris. I got to live that. She did not. Gomez thinks Selena's legacy has grown for all the right reasons. When you see interviews of her, you see she was truly a sweet young woman, a nice girl. She said, I don't want to intentionally hurt anyone. I don't want to hurt people's feelings. People are fascinated with that legend. My Facebook is bombarded with Selena fans in their 20s and teens. They weren't around and don't really know. They grew up with the movie. They only know the performer they see on YouTube. Because of that, Gomez believes, Selena's eye for innovation in fashion and design has been overlooked. People today are missing that this girl was more than a singer and performer. She was a visionary. Jennifer Lopez took what Selena was doing and used it as a roadmap. It's hard to create a new idea in fashion. I know that now. And back in 1993, Selena had this new idea. On a sunny, picture-perfect October day, I retraced the path I'd taken 2 days after Selena's death, driving 198 miles from my house in the Texas Hill Country to Corpus Christi, exiting right on People's Street. The Days Inn, where Selena was shot, was the Knights Inn now, hidden behind a newer Hampton Inn and a newer Holiday Inn Express. I had been in Corpus Christi several times over the past 25 years, but I hadn't been to Selena's Corpus Christi since my book tour. In those days, immediately after Selena's death, a scattering of fans had placed wreaths and improvised a shrine outside the room where she was shot, while others pored over the St. Augustine grass by the pool, some on hands and knees, examining her path from room 158 to the lobby, clutching in her hand the ring that Saldivar had bought for her with money skimmed from Selena's businesses. The motel had aged through multiple exterior paint jobs. The front desk and lobby had been refashioned into the Las Milpas restaurant. The pool looked the same. The Washington Palms hovered above the property, stately and beautiful as ever, but fixtures appeared well used and tired. You could say the same for the city. Despite downtown additions like the Whataburger Field Ballpark and the American Bank Center Arena, the town otherwise looked like the refinery port it is. Whataburger, Corpus's best-known brand besides Selena, had moved its corporate headquarters to San Antonio. At the Visitor Information Center downtown, an older Anglo woman at the front desk drew two circles on a giveaway city map to show the city's Selena sites: the Selena Memorial on Shoreline Boulevard, and the Selena Museum at Q Productions at 5410 Leopard Street. "It's a warehouse-looking building in an industrial area," she said. "That's a working recording studio there, as well as a small museum. Admission is $3. "Anywhere else?" The lady paused, then offered directions to the gravesite at Seaside Memorial Park and Funeral Home on Ocean Drive. "What about the Selena Auditorium? Is there a marker there?" The lady didn't know, but I was only a block away, and I could probably double park near the loading area to see for myself. "But I didn't tell you that," she said, smiling impishly. I drove over to the American Bank Center, double parked near the loading area with my flashers on, and went inside. The venue where Selena y Los Dinos had performed, and where Selena's body lay in state for public viewing, was now the Selena Auditorium, attached to a convention center and 10,000-seat arena. The old Bayfront Plaza Auditorium was renamed in 1996 and had been updated twice since. A large full-body oil portrait of Selena, singing with her eyes closed, hung prominently on a column in the high-ceiling lobby outside the 2,500-seat venue, along with a brief explanation of her life. Dedicated in memory of Selena Quintanilla Perez, the American Bank Center Selena Auditorium will forever serve as a reminder of all that Selena achieved as an entertainer and a remarkable human being. With dignity and kindness, she touched our hearts. With music, she touched our souls. 8 blocks down Shoreline, by the bayfront seawall, 15 people milled around a modified gazebo in the mid-afternoon sun. This was where the Selena Memorial, Mirador de la Flor, Overlook of the Flower, by the People's Saint T-Head, and the Corpus Christi Marina. Dedicated in 1997, the memorial's centerpiece is a life-size bronze of Selena wearing a short jacket, blouse, jeans, and boots, leaning comfortably against the gazebo's main column, one leg propped back. On the other side of the column is a sculptured rose. A recorded voice briefly told Selena's story in English and in Spanish. Many of the bricks surrounding the sculpture bore the names of donors who helped pay for the memorial. Others were decorated with hand-scrawled signatures of fans who had made the pilgrimage, a disproportionate number of visitors from Jalisco State in Mexico. Three women, all Mexican-American, took selfie photos at the statue. When I started to take a photo of them taking photos, one told the others in Spanish to move. "It's okay," I said. "I want to have people in the photo." A woman in her 50s grinned and started talking to me in English. I saw her in El Paso when she was just starting out. She was so talented and so good. I felt it immediately. When my daughter started listening to her, she really got into her music big time. I said, "How can you like her? You never saw her." "But she does." The woman shook her head as she turned to leave. "Yeah, it's so sad." A thin, elderly Hispanic man pushed a teenaged girl in a wheelchair up to the statue, and both looked up somberly. As I walked away, an Anglo woman who appeared to have seen better days approached with the question, "Got a cigarette?" I cruised Ocean Drive to the Seaside Memorial Park and Funeral Home, passing the fanciest homes in the city. Somehow, I knew where to go, even though the graveside had changed. A concrete walkway led from the roadside curb to a low black iron fence that had been erected around the grave. A small sign at the gate read, "Stay out. Respect gravesite." The headstone with the familiar Selena script logo loomed behind a bronze head and shoulders likeness of Selena that covered the headstone on her actual grave. Behind the headstone, a planted mesquite tree, the iconic tree of South Texas, had grown large enough to provide protective shade. A plaque identified Selena Quintanilla Perez, followed by a Bible passage from Isaiah 25:8, written in English and Spanish. And there were white roses, the singer's favorite, left by pilgrim fans. Como la flor, like the flower. Three women, two men and two children, walked to the gate and paused. "We're from Alice," a woman in her 30s volunteered. "Our grandmother is over there. We haven't been to see her in almost a year," she said apologetically. "So we came to see Selena. I wonder how often her family comes here." The group paid their respects. The only sounds were the steady breezes coming in from the gulf and the whirs, whistles, and clicks of shiny black grackles perched in the branches of the mesquite. The sounds were eternal. Nothing else seemed what it once was. The Selena Etc. boutique and salon by the mall had closed. The record shop, where Abraham Quintanilla was mentored by Johnny Herrera, a singer and performer from the 1950s known as El Suspiro de las Damas, the heartthrob, was gone. On the other hand, La Molina, the working-class neighborhood where Selena and her husband Chris Perez lived in a brick house in between her parents' brick house and her sister and her sister's husband's brick house on one small lot, looked neater and tidier than it did 25 years ago, like the community had grown even more tight-knit. The simple bungalows were humble but well-kept. Molina looked like a neighborhood where everyone knew everyone else. No signage identified the three houses at the end of Bloomington Street as Quintanilla property or Selena's last residence, although she and Chris had bought property outside of Corpus and planned to move there to raise chickens and babies, she had told me. A couple of blocks down at the corner of Elvira Drive, a Selena mural with three of her likenesses that was painted in 2019 covered the street side wall of the food store. I drove over to Leopard Street and slowed by the entrance to the Selena Museum and Q Productions, a metal building housing a recording studio and museum behind a black iron gate topped by three strands of barbed wire. 10 people mingled around the parking area in front of the building. At the back of the lot were trucks and the tour bus, as if Los Dinos was preparing to go out on the road again. I had been to Q Productions to interview Abraham 3 days after his daughter's death. We hugged at the end. For a brief period, he suggested we collaborate on a book, but the deal fell apart when he began to dictate what could and couldn't be said. He declared her Jehovah's Witnesses faith off limits. This time, though, after pausing, I drove on. Too many ghosts were inside that fence. Too many dark memories. It's time to move on, I thought to myself. Fat chance. On the way out of Corpus Christi, a billboard on Interstate 37 caught my eye. The B County Coliseum in nearby Beeville was presenting Carla Perez and Selena the Show. I switched on the radio and Beedy Beedy Bomb Bomb came on.